Good day, nerds, and welcome to episode 141 of the Nerd Cantina Show. And today we've got a cantina conversation between our book reviewer Megan McCarthy-Bianc and Luke Cunningham. In this interview, they're going to go over his upcoming book, Leo, Inventor Extraordinaire, which is a new release coming out here on April 2nd. As always, Megan does a great job having a loose and candid conversation with the author about his history, the specifics on writing this book, and any future projects coming up. This is a fun and entertaining interview. Hopefully you enjoy.
So we're here with Luke Cunningham, author of Leo, Inventor Extraordinaire. Thank you so much for squeezing us in. I know this is such an exciting time for you. You're kind of rounding up on, the last month of your release. I'm excited for you. This is your debut. So, thanks so much for taking the time to talk to us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah. So we'll go ahead and why don't you tell us a little bit about your background since this is your debut novel and, you kind of switched gears a little bit compared to like your past professional endeavors.
Oh, so prior to this, I was a late night writer, most successfully on when it was late night with Jimmy Fallon, and then it became The Tonight Show. So I worked there from late 2012 to start of 2016, and just loved that job and that industry. And prior to that, I worked on some other late night shows, primarily as a joke writer. Mm-hmm. And had also I wrote for a few sitcoms, hastily canceled sitcoms. Oh. But so this was a departure from writing jokes for a living. And then I guess jokes are like pretty simple machines, just like there's always a setup, and then in late night there's a punchline, and that punchline it has to be a surprise. That's why the joke works. You couldn't see it coming. And to go from like your job there is you are just constantly building these little machines, and then switch from that to this where you're just building one huge machine.
Sure.
It's different. It makes your brain work in a different way.
Yeah. And so, because I imagine kind of different industries, different like writing methods, maybe a little bit, and also probably much fewer cooks in the kitchen with writing a novel, so to speak.
The cooks in the kitchen process on a late night show is wild. Because I would every day by 11 a.m. I would submit 4 pages of jokes, which were about like 40 jokes. And I'm sure I could still write a Rob Ford joke. Like if you forced me to in a room, I could crank out 10 of them. Anthony Weiner was writing a ton of Anthony Weiner jokes. Chris Christie actually walked into our writer's room one time.
Oh my God.
And nobody noticed him right away. Are you allowed to? You don't want us to curse on this, right?
Oh, no, do whatever you want. We're fine. Oh. Yeah, I think it's identified. It's categorized appropriately on podcast.
Oh, okay.
Players. So,
I think a lot of people, the concept of a late night writer's room is just a bunch of people sitting around throwing jokes at each other. And it is not that. It is just an angry library of people trying to get their jokes on the show. You're all friends. Everybody's got, everybody's got a cool brain, but like every 3 months that your contract is 3 months. So you're trying to keep your job every 3 months. So everybody is just trying to get their jokes on the show. Everyone is facing away from the door. And then I just kind of like sense this presence and I can like nudge the people next to me. And we turned around and it was Chris Christie and all we did, like every show we would have like a Chris Christie joke. He was just, hanging on fun. And we all turn around and he just slowly pans the room and goes, "You motherfuckers."
Oh my goodness.
All right. Chris Christie. There are way less cooks in the kitchen here. It was me and my editor, his name's Jackie Alberta. She did a wonderful job. It's just great to have somebody who like calls you out on things constantly when you're, and it's not in the only investment on her part is just making something better.
Sure.
And so it's you know, I mean, it's tough when someone is like, hey, this doesn't work, because you're like, you're the person who made it. So now you don't like beat your brain. But God, she was wonderful at really hammering parts of the original story that she was like, I'm just not into this. Fix it.
Oh, okay. I'm wondering like how that process went. Did you always, the intended audience is like middle grade, like 8 to 12 year olds, something like that. Right. So was that a choice by you just from the nature of the character, Leo, and maybe the nature of his story, or kind of like, you know, did you always have that in mind of your intended audience?
Yeah. I mean, I imagined me being 12 years old and being told to go read The Chocolate War or one of these other books. Like, I'm thinking of books that I enjoy. Like, I enjoyed A Separate Piece, but they're always like set in some place that I couldn't really recognize, or were just having experiences where I was like, they just weren't that. Like, I wasn't that engaged in a lot of the work. So I was trying to write a book that like 12 to 13 year old me would have enjoyed, and that like my friends at the time would have enjoyed, because then I felt like I was a reader and sometimes get excited about these books. And I'd be like, guys, you've got to read this book. And my friends would be like, I got 3 pages in and was my skull. And so I was just trying to write that. And I think it's, the chapters are very short and they kind of end on little cliffhangers. Mm-hmm. And I was just trying to incorporate all of the tricks that they use in, for lack of a better word, dad fiction.
Okay.
Dad's reading on the beach.
Okay.
So, you know, it's always like a cop who does things his own way, like that type of thing.
There's
always done at the end of the chapter. So I was trying to incorporate those just like, and make it as readable as possible.
It was, because I love getting sucked in, but I love that the chapters were so quick, because then it was like 4 pages later, like, you know, it was just easy to like to stop and pick it back up again, and without feeling like you had to like commit too much time to it, even though I was able to power through it, I think, in like just a few days. And I mean, I had just had my second boy like 3 months ago. And so I don't have the luxury of like carving out, you know, hours at a time the short chapters, I definitely appreciate. It was really easy. And plus because your writing style, it gave away, like, I also enjoyed how you kind of, you kind of switched back and forth a little bit of between perspectives. Mm-hmm. And so it was kind of like, you know, the reader kind of sees all the different parts. And while Leo only sees some parts, or Beatrice only sees some parts, and it's kind of, it all also adds to like the anticipation of, it's like, oh, they're going to meet. Okay. What's it going to be like? What's going to happen? Just meet so that we can see what, you know, what happens next, kind of thing.
So you have a 3-month-old right now?
Yeah. And a 3-year-old. Yeah.
We have an 18-month-old. So I had to finish this, the book, really kind of March, April of last year.
Okay. So like right when the world started going on fire.
And he was, you know, he was about 6 or 7 months old at the time. You completely understand that pattern of they're asleep, let's go.
Yes.
And then you just try and crank as hard as possible while they were asleep.
Exactly.
You were asking earlier how I wrote it, and that was it. It was just like, he's down for a nap, let's set a timer, and here we go.
That's and even then, that can be so challenging, because it's like really hard to get in the zone, I imagine. But maybe that's almost kind of similar of how it was when you were writing jokes for the Tonight Show, because then it's like, you know, that's when, I guess, because you can write on your own time, but then it's like, you know, that there's that time where you all meet to hammer on each other's work, and so. Mm. Maybe that was one of the skills that you kind of transferred over to, in addition, like mixed with parenthood and all that.
Well, I think one of the skills that really transferred over is just not being precious about your work. Like, if I'm enormously tall, I'm about 6'6".
Okay. And
my work review happened with Fallon. And I would just, you know, you're talking about the process. And I was like, If I got 2 jokes in the show, it was out of those 40 jokes, if 2 made it on, you were thrilled. And anybody who was writing would be thrilled. I was like, Jimmy, if I get 2 jokes in the show, I walk home, I feel like I'm 10 feet tall.
Yeah.
And he was like, well, Luke, that's because you're actually 10 feet tall.
Yeah.
You goon.
He's like, don't give him too much credit, right?
Yeah.
That's cool. No, that's great. Yeah. And I imagine it was a different kind of pressure, I'm guessing. Like, what was the kind of like the biggest lessons learned from, you know, changing the medium for your art?
Oh, I mean, the pressure is like, now I have a mouth that I have to feed.
Yep.
I mean, when you're 34 years old and hanging out in New York and writing jokes for this fun show that was like the hottest show on TV at the time. And now you're in an apartment in LA and just like looking at this kid being like, I would like the good milk. So right. Working on that book, Dad.
I know. Right?
Yeah. It's if you are not an efficient person in terms of your work ethic, having a child will really kick that into gear quite quickly.
Either crush it or kick it up definitely kind of rewires your you're either going to figure out a way to do it, or you're going to decide like, maybe, you know, if I can't make it happen, then maybe I need to like look at some things differently type of thing. Yeah. And yeah, no, I get it. That's why I'm like, because I do work full time, but I'm also, you know, trying to be appreciative that I have a job, but that also I can like work from home part time too. Cause just being able to find that free time and then be able to do fun stuff like this. And like, you know, cause you obviously you care about your work, and you know, it's a different type of investment compared to your, you know, your background before tackling this project. How did you develop the idea, like Leo's story? Like, how did you come up with that? Like, what kind of research went into that? Because there's so much fun stuff going on. And I love the fact that, you know, the nature of like just the intended audience in general. Like, I love that this type of book is intended for this type of audience, because like, I felt like when I finished the book, I felt like I learned something, like a couple different things. Yeah. And I just, that was so cool. Cause it was like, you know what, you're not only like reading an adventure and some kid's story, but you're like, you're kind of seeing his mind work. But at the same time, I'm like, Leo is way smarter than I am, but still it was like, I learned something anyway. It was, yeah. You know,
well, Leo is way smarter than me. I think I remember going for a run in this neighborhood and had just read this whole thing about how Leonardo da Vinci really did make a working robot lion 500 years ago.
Oh.
And it was 500 pounds and was made of wood, and it would take 3 steps forward, and when it would roar, it would display a bouquet of lilies. And that blew my mind so much. And then I just started reading more and more about the, you know, like the things that he did. He built a canal lock that is still the canal lock design that is used around the world. Like, if you've ever gone through a canal, if you've ever seen a canal, the lock design was designed by Leonardo da Vinci.
Oh, wow.
Who just on an afternoon started looking at canals and the canal locks around Milan and was like, there's got to be a better way to do this. And then went and executed that. And for me, like, it's really hard to not sound pretentious when doing this, but it just, sure. I'm trying to get the kids who might end up like running a hedge fund or doing some app that's going to be like, I found a way to disrupt public school teachers. And it's like, no, don't do that. Like, please take whatever beautiful, competent, multivalent brain of yours and direct it towards something that is going to be more beneficial for an entire community.
Right.
So I grew up outside Philadelphia, and Philadelphia is ostensibly one of those kind of coastal cities, but we grew up in this one section called Upper Darby, and Upper Darby and Delaware County, Pennsylvania are kind of like the Rust Belt section of a coastal elite city. Does that make sense? Like, it's just kind of one of the sections that is vaguely abandoned. And so like that was part of my concept of Leo and Peter Wynn. In it, like, it talks repeatedly about how Peter Wynn built this company and revived a community, revived his city. And I'm just like, God, I'm so hopeful that there are going to be more and more kids who look at things that way, of rather than like, I'm going to move to San Francisco and I'm going to ride a scooter to work and I'm going to way to like ruin minimum wage, versus like, hey, I'm going to move to Upper Darby, Pennsylvania, and I'm going to convert the old quarry into a wildly vibrant idea-based economy. So like, and I'm hoping to get those kids who have those winning lottery ticket brains and just kind of like capturing them with a fun book. I realize this is like, it's very aspirational, but God, I'm just, the best case scenario is a kid 20 years from now doing way better than me, but comes up and is like, hey, I took this one bit from your book and I applied it to this, like, and it made me think of this other thing. And now I've created 20,000 jobs in this city that had been a forgotten little pocket of and so that was kind of the ethos that led to it.
Yeah, no, and honestly, I think I could tell that. I definitely got that, because like, it's one of the things I loved about Leo is that no matter, like, it's he's notorious for, like, yes, he invents a lot of things, but a lot of them do not work, or they work catastrophically, and it's like, you know, and he always, like, you hear him like overthinking it. He's like, oh, I always overlook this like one detail. And once you kind of put it in like simple terms like that, it's like you teach readers, which is why I love the age range for this, is like you kind of teach them like pay attention. You know, pay attention in class, because Leo had to use like little tidbits from his lessons to solve the puzzles underneath the school. And then he also was very he was made aware of, like, you know, you're teaching kids like, don't, you know, try not to overlook things, or try to be thorough, try to pay attention not only to like your education, but also like how you can apply that. And, you know, you can avoid as many mistakes as possible, if, you know, even though you learn by making mistakes most of the time, but you can, as you know, hopefully it's not by overlooking something simple. And then also what I loved about him was that he, even no matter how many times like his inventions like screwed things up, he still like never lost that enthusiasm. Like, he was still like ready to handle the next task. And he still, once he got like an idea in his head, he got so excited. And like, you feel that on the page. And like, I think that's why it's so important. And that's why I appreciate you, the intended audience. Cause it's like, you think, you know, middle grade, sixth, seventh, eighth graders. And you're like, you know, if it, you're thinking like, they're still sponges, they're still like, you know, they're still very impressionable. And I think, yeah, not only is it challenging to like kind of capture their and keep their attention, but also hopefully that they get something out of it. And that's why, like, I totally appreciated like where you went with Leo's character.
My editor describes it as slipping in some spinach into the brownies.
Yeah.
they're like, oh, this is a fun adventure book, and there's some jokes, and there's like a monkey who's slapping people around.
Yeah.
And I think I accidentally learned how to look at things in a museum. I was like, right. that's what we're going for. And I mean, like, everything that every character in the book is true to their Renaissance counterpart. So like, Da Vinci really did not know his father until he was 13 years old.
Yeah, I didn't know that.
Yeah. Rocky is based on Verrocchio, who was the teacher to whom Da Vinci was apprenticed by his father. Eventually, like, obviously sometimes some stuff I have to be a little fast and loose with, like, Verrocchio never taught Leonardo da Vinci's father. He wasn't related to Niccolo Machiavelli. That's just kind of mixing stuff, some stuff in with the Renaissance. Sure. But like, we're talking about how Leo always forgets a key detail. Like, that's kind of, that was true of da Vinci. Like, he had this exhaustively curious brain, and he almost stumbled upon the scientific method, where he would just continue to test ideas. And I think that, you know, like, the real scientific method wasn't codified until about 100 years later. But like, Da Vinci's final words were, I've offended God and mankind because my work did not reach the quality it should have.
No.
Like,
he was still
beating himself up on his deathbed after building all of these incredible things and arriving at all these wild conclusions. He was still like, oh, there's still some, I keep missing these little details to make things as well as I possibly could.
And it kind of speaks to him. Like, you know, there are probably, you know, countless inventors or engineers or just brilliant minds in general who look up to him and who study him and who thought they like, oh my God, I could never be a Da Vinci, or I could never have done that. But it's like, he, you know, it kind of like speaks to, you know, putting too much pressure on yourself and setting that bar so high. It was because like, he was a brilliant mind in itself, and who knows where we would be without, you know, without his lasting like legacy, but it's like to know that on his deathbed, he was just like, oh, I could have done this better. It was like, what? Like, really? Like, I don't know. Like you did enough, you know, it's like you should, you know, but I kind of like, I can see that because it's like, you know, when you like with a brilliant mind like that, in retrospect, you're probably like, oh, I should have done things differently, or I should, you know, like after the fact, you're kind of reminiscing or you're kind of evaluating your work. And, you know, even though on the surface you kind of look like maybe you have your shit together and like, you know, that you're confident, but maybe then you realize like, no, like somebody's got something everybody's got something that they're,
everyone does.
They're questioning or they're like some element of self-doubt one way or the other.
If that guy didn't think he was doing enough, what help is there? What hope is
there? Oh, it's so true.
You have somebody whose brain you're genuinely jealous of, like somebody where you're just like, wow, that is a wonderful total package of a brain.
Right. And then to have him just be like, no, it's not. Just like what? Then what, you know, who would he look up to? It's kind of like, but it's like, you look at like, even if you look at the time period, like people around that time, I feel like it was kind of rare to have that type of brain too, or at least to be able to have the resources to exercise, you know, that brain and to be able to like, you know, flesh it out, let alone be successful.
He was at the time viewed as like, he was a celebrity for all intents and purposes, in his own time, but he was like, so he was a tall, like beautiful looking dude. He was jacked out of his mind. The Vitruvian Man, that's him. That is a self portrait. He was a wrestling champion. He vegetarian, left-handed, openly gay for the time. And he also, like, he was the greatest set designer in the world. Like, they used to, like, other kingdoms would be like, please, our Fat Tuesday production is going to be terrible. Please send Leonardo over. And, like, he would do that, but he almost, like, didn't want to do it.
Right,
He was bothered by it. There's a great anecdote in the Leonardo da Vinci biography by Walter Isaacson, where he talks about the Lady with an Ermine, that painting where the woman's holding the like little mink ferret looking thing and turning towards it. Da Vinci painted that because he was like best friends with that woman. He had a bath hanging out with her, and she had some like wonky friend who demanded that Da Vinci do a portrait of her like that. And the whole anecdote in the book is just Da Vinci boom roasting this woman to a friend, being like, this, why is she still sending me letters? He was like, he was funny. It's just, there's, you know, he's one of those people who I'm reading about. And I'm like, I'm jealous of the brain that you got.
Right.
Yeah. Like, do you ever read Tina Fey's book?
The Bossy Pants?
Yes.
Yeah. I listened to the audiobook, like, I don't even know, at least 6 years ago, maybe.
I mean, Tina Fey's brain, I can't get like just the way that Tina Fey's brain works. I'm just like, Jesus.
I can think of as Leslie Knope.
What's Amy Poehler?
Yes. Yeah. It's like, why? It's like, I'm about to like praise her and I can't even remember her name.
Yeah.
No, yeah. I listen to Yes Please too. And I think, I don't know. I think I just, maybe, because I just like the Parks and Rec has like a little bit of a more of a special place in my heart. And so maybe I just kind of like gravitated and liked Amy Poehler more. But no, the both of them are very, they're very talented, very, very nice working brains.
Do you think you have more of an affinity for Parks and Rec because you're from the Midwest?
Probably. Yeah. It was Indiana. And it was like, yeah, I'm like in a suburb of Chicago. So that could be why. But because I did watch 30 Rock 2, which also has a good cast. But yeah, I don't know. I think I just, Parks and Rec, maybe the humor in general kind of like caught me a little bit better. Yeah. Or I, you know, because they were kind of filmed differently too. And I don't know. I think I just liked and maybe who knows, like at the time when I first like started watching both of those two, maybe a place in my life I don't even remember might have had something to do with it. But yeah, no, that could be something, like that could have a lot to do with the fact that I'm like around Chicago area and there's like Pawnee, Indiana.
Yeah.
And stuff like that. Yeah. I had no idea. And now this book kind of like makes me want to maybe do a little bit more research on Leonardo da Vinci now, just from because Leo is such a fascinating character. And the fact that he like goes through, you know, most of his childhood, all of his childhood without like knowing his dad. And then all of a sudden, like everything changes once he, you know, he finds these clues and he sees these puzzles and his life is if his life, his life, you know, kind of seemed to have certainly had exciting elements to it, which is from his brain. And I'm like, how does he's in this like boarding school. Like, how does he have access to all these gadgets to begin with? Like, how does he, you know, and you know, how does he like have all these tools to like make a robot lion or a little like mechanical monkey that like has, you know, it's essentially its own mind and to be able to help him with things. It's, you know, and I just thought it was like, you know, kind of fascinating too. It was like another little thing, like, okay, like where, you know, he was, it just, maybe it just spoke to like his creativity and, his resourcefulness and stuff like that. Because his, Miss Medici didn't seem too keen on letting him have access to anything in general, based on his track record.
Well, that is also kind of based on the real history of it, is that eventually Da Vinci left Florence and went to Milan and kind of annoyed the Medicis.
Okay.
Early, because he left a lot of unused or unfinished projects.
Oh, okay.
Like the Hall of the 500 is in Palazzo Vecchio, the you know, the giant tower that is familiar with everyone from the center of Florence.
Yeah.
And so there were these two giant paintings on either side, and one was supposed to be Da Vinci and the other was supposed was Michelangelo, and they were painting and they did not like each other.
Okay.
Michelangelo was like a grade A weirdo. Like, so like, you know, and Da Vinci was like the social chair. Like Da Vinci is, there are dozens of people who on their, you know, in their memoirs on their deathbed were like, my best friend ever was Leonardo da Vinci. No one says that about Michelangelo. And, so he eventually left, and he there's all types of controversy with the painting that he left behind and like whether or not he forgot a key detail about what he was painting, and the paint started to run.
Oh.
And rather than stick around to fix it, because he was also like, he and Michelangelo were both famous at the time.
Sure.
And like famous artists, and they were competing with each other.
Right.
And he like, rather than like stay there and fix it, he just bolted to deal with it. And that is a little bit of you know, I mean, eventually he leaves. I'm not ruining anything by giving away spoilers in the story, but he leaves the Academy of Florence. His best friend that he has the rivalry with in the Academy of Florence, Savvy, is based on Savonarola, not Michelangelo.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
But, yeah. Savonarola famously led the Bonfire of the Vanities, burned, they're estimating it's like $20 billion worth of Renaissance art in the center of Florence at the time. I mean, obviously it wasn't worth $20 billion then, but
sure.
Everything that got burned in there. And you know who had him throw a bunch of stuff on the fire? That weirdo Michelangelo.
Yeah. That's okay. So there's like a lot. I feel okay. So this book definitely would go much further with enthusiasts of like Italian history, or even some sort of maybe like art or engineering history. Cause obviously I feel like, you know, if depending on maybe like the kind of route you take in studying any sort of like engineering or inventing or what have you, or artwork, you're going to cross their stories. Right. Yeah.
You were given a copy. Did you get an illustrated copy?
No, I didn't. But I saw some of your sketches like on when I was looking you up and looking more of the story up online. So I'm a little bit jealous that I didn't get a sketch copy, which is fine. No, but
we'll have to send you a copy with the illustrations in it.
Oh, sure. Yeah. No, because I think I saw like a couple of them. So did you sketch those out, and that help you kind of like visualize the story or in like some of your descriptions? Cause there's a lot going on.
I have literally zero visual art talent. Like, okay. There are many things I'm good at, and that is, boy, is that not one of them.
Sure. So,
we found this great illustrator named Teresa Schiecki. I might be mispronouncing her name. She is she's Italian. Mm-hmm. But she moved from Italy. She lives in Key West, Florida, and she has an interest in, she had a interest in history, and I was like, great, you're gonna have to try and mimic Leonardo da Vinci stuff. Okay. You know, no mean feat. But she, she did a great job with, so there's like the thing with the hands in one of the first puzzles is talking about how hard it is to paint hands. Yeah. And I mean, one of my favorite stories from art history class when I was in college was Salvador Dali was in, obviously he's not a Renaissance painter, but it just like in terms of painting and like visual art, I always found this so interesting. He was in art school in Andalusia, and they're all painting, and his, you know, obviously his teacher is probably a successful artist themselves, but they're now running a school, and they've continued to tell him like, hey, you have to paint what we're painting. And he's like, uh-huh. And then he's in the back of class painting, you know, 400 foot tall elephants, whatever he's doing. And when you're learning how to paint, like they make you paint a lot of hands and a lot of still lifes, because it's hard to capture the way that light hits an orange or like a loaf of bread. And it's hard to articulate hands because hands are so, there's so many like, you know, there's so many changing shapes and the geometry that's in hands. Yeah. And so eventually this teacher, they're in the middle of class, and he catches Dali not painting what they're supposed to again. And just is like, that's it. You're out. Like, you have 24 hours, pack your things and get out. And so he goes up to his room and is just doing nothing but painting for the next 24 hours before his train home comes. He folds up this canvas, slides it under his teacher's door, and on the canvas is written, I have no greater ambition in life than to be what I am, Salvador Dali. And then when you open it up, it is a photorealistic pair of hands cracking apart a loaf of bread.
Oh, wow.
And he like never painted anything else like that in his life. He only painted that one time, and it was as a fuck you to somebody.
Yeah, it was like, this is what I was working on, and this, like, you know, he probably knew it was like amazing, and but that's that's probably what he was like aiming for. He was like, no, I'm gonna get this down, like, I'm going to do this, and this is what I like, I'm gonna show you, like, this is what I was working on, like, happy birthday, like, here, this is for you.
I could do what you want me to do at a genius level anytime I need to,
right?
Peace. I'm gonna go continue to, like, I'm gonna go make a giant lobster phone. And that painting is in, it's in the museum in St. Petersburg, the Dali Museum. And it's just like, you're walking around and it's nothing but these, you know, like magical realism paintings. And then it's just a pair of hands cracking apart a loaf of bread. It's like, and he did it cause he was mad.
Right. He was like, stop yelling at me. Leave me alone. Like, this is what I'm working on. Like, trust me, it's amazing. So then, have you ever been to Italy then, or?
I have. Okay. I've been to Florence and Venice and Milan, and a lot of it was, we went to Florence and Venice in 2013 when I was starting to do research and writing this book.
Yeah. Okay. So you started like about 8 years ago, cause I was like going to get to that. Cause no, I don't remember how long ago it was, maybe about 5 years ago. Maybe it was like 2015, and maybe it was like 2016. I went with my husband's family to Italy. It was like a 2-week escorted tour, so we bounced around the country, and, you know, from like our wake up call was at like 6 a.m. and we had an itinerary every day, but it's just because there's so much to see, like, everywhere you go, and that's just the food, like, you there's plenty to do if you're only on a food or drink and wine tour, and wine is so cheap because everybody's making it in their backyard.
Oh my god, we got a loaf of Italian bread in the train station in Florence, because you just like get off a flight, whatever, right there. And I was like, this is like all time top five bread I've ever seen. And then you go, like, the things I feel like they do incredibly well are food and clothing. And then like, cause we walked outside and there was a garbage truck, like literally a garbage truck is going by. And these guys were dressed better than I was on my wedding day. You know what I'm saying? They're wearing three-piece suits, like beautiful three-piece suits.
Yeah.
And I was just like, yeah, God bless this country.
Right.
For just doing it right.
Exactly. No, I know. And it's because like even that type of job is like, it's so important too, like that type of work, but it's like, it's nice to have, and it's like, you know, yeah, you're handling garbage. Like how much crap could you get on that expensive suit? It's like, well, it doesn't matter, I guess.
You're in a union and you're hanging out on the back of a truck in a gorgeous three-piece suit. It was white with green piping. Do you know how confident you have to be to wear white to pick up garbage?
Oh my goodness. Oh my goodness. Yeah, it probably like just speaks to the dignity that they were also trying to like portray to. Like it's just a respect for the profession in general. Like, you know, it's just such a stark contrast to, you know, how our the industries are here. But no, that's what, I think I remember even, when you speak about the clothing, it's like my husband and I, we bit the bullet and we did purchase some Italian leather in Florence, and it was just like, it was so beautiful. Like, and it was just like, no, this is like, we're going to go for it. Like, this is our nice treat from this trip. And it was, you know, and even then, you know, we got our initials like in engraved on it, and it was that was like probably one of the more fun trips. So that's why when I got into this story and like hearing you talk about like, oh, where you went and like talking, like touching on the history, a lot of it was like coming back to me. And it's like, you know, even if I went back to Italy, I would feel like, you know, I would know kind of like where I would want to revisit. Maybe I'd want to spend a little bit more time. I mean, I think Florence was definitely in the top three because we visited like 14 or 15 cities. Florence was definitely there. Sorrento and the island of Capri was very, very fun. I think mostly the limoncello, but also just like the scenery. I mean, the whole country is beautiful, but with all the like, the scenery, the foliage, all of that. And then if I had to pick a third place that was like probably my top favorite, I don't know. I feel like in Milan, I would have spent too much money if I spent too much time there, even though as beautiful as everything was. But Venice was probably like amongst the top two, just because it was so cool and unique how that city was laid out. And I mean, there's history wherever you go.
I mean, everywhere it's like you look at a building and it's like, this building is 1200 years old.
Yeah.
But I mean, I live in Los Angeles where people would be like, that building is so old. You're like, it was built in 1986.
Right.
It's a mall.
Right.
But I wanted to get to Venice because I was so worried that it was going to be wiped off the map.
Yeah. That's what they said. You could see the water lines. You could see like how they kind of try to prepare for it, of when the tide gets too high and stuff. And I remember, I think when I think like years ago in the news, I think I read about how, you know, the storms were bad or something like that. And it was getting, it's parts of the city were getting like flooded because it's just like a bunch of islands all next to each other. And then plus that's where you're supposed to get your masks too, the Venetian masks, which.
Wait, you mean like the plague masks or like pandemic masks?
No. Not the pandemic masks. No, okay. Like the fancy, like, you know, intricate with the like artwork and embroidery and feathers and all that. Yeah. Because they have the Carnival fest every, you know, I think every year.
I brought one of those home for my niece who was 5, almost 6 years old at the time. And I've never seen a kid look more disappointed with a very expensive gift. She's like, cool, thanks. Oh, porcelain mask that I never wear. Thanks, Uncle.
Well, let's hope, you know, give it about 10 or 15 years, maybe she'll start to appreciate it a little bit more. Like,
I just gave her an Aviator Nation sweatshirt for Christmas, so hopefully she's fine.
If not, you're just the goofy uncle, who knows.
Yeah. Right.
You're living up to the name. So yeah, so you came up with this story and started studying and researching for it back in 2012, 2013, you said. And so did it take you that long to write it, or did it just kind of take you that long to get the ball rolling in terms of like pitching it and getting it published?
So I had a draft in 2012, 2013, a publisher was excited about. And then I was like, okay, well, let me just work on some more stuff because I want to take it in a little bit of a different direction. And I handed it in, and that publisher was no longer excited about it.
Oh, no.
It was honestly, it was, it got shot down at a number of places. And I, you know, like the idea that people get indignant about rejection, I want to email every one of these people who said no to it. And not like, and be like, hey, this got published, but like, thank you, because you, like, every one of them gave me some type of feedback. And every time that like helped change the trajectory of where I was going with it.
Right.
I mean, I'm trying to like, and just there was a version in 2015, there was a version in 2017, and like that version in 2015 was 60 pages. The version in 2017 was 120 page sample. And then Zondervan was excited about a version that was 160 pages in 2019. And so it was just constantly going in and refining the big machine of the book. Like I knew where I wanted it to end up. And I kind of knew the details and like the what the puzzles were going to be comprised of. And I just remember like getting so excited sitting in my apartment in Brooklyn in 2013 and being like, oh, this will be cool. Oh, this will be cool. And then I'd find something else. And like the tough part is the space between, oh, this will be cool, and how do I communicate that in a fun way that contributes to a narrative?
Oh yeah.
Because otherwise it's just like a listicle of like, hey, here's some cool stuff that Da Vinci did. And wouldn't it be fun if we could find a way to have it happen again? Cause I mean, the fact that the book is set in the near future is, I don't know, like it didn't occur to me to set it at any other time. Like the idea of having this happen during the Renaissance, I don't find that as exciting as trying to synthesize the past and the present into a more fun and exciting future.
Yeah. And it's almost kind of like, well, what would Leonardo da Vinci do, or what kind of things would he have come up with and contributed to the world if he was, you know, born now?
Yeah.
You know, and he grew up in then like 20, 30 years from now, what would he have to offer? How, you know, given the technology now, given the history now, you know, even still, it was just like, you know, what if he had his hands on such much more advanced technology, like who knows?
And that's what I mean, that's what I'm trying to do, is like, hopefully the kid who is Da Vinci now is looking at that and like looking at my idea for a cold fusion reactor in that book and is like, oh, you were not even close, dummy. But here's what could actually work. And you know, it's because he read a book that has like a half dozen poop jokes in it.
Yeah, right.
Finds a way.
I mean, when you put a mechanical monkey in there, it's like really hard to avoid.
Yeah,
you know? Yeah. No, that's
like introducing a gun in the first act. Sorry.
No, it's fine. No, I was just, you know, kind of touching on that is, you know, just kind of backtracking to what I was saying before, is how it was so important that age range, you kind of grab a hold of whatever attention you can get, and you kind of grab a hold of whatever, push out like whatever lessons you can, because yeah, it's like, you know, some, and then also what I loved about it was like, you weren't, you know, everybody is like, of course, like the science and technology and mathematics, it's all very important. And then it's like, you know, that's kind of like the meat and potatoes of how you're going to like create great things that would benefit, you know, communities and whatnot. But I love how you were like also sprinkling in tidbits of, you know, some some like music in there and some artwork in there and some, even some religion, like a little bit of scripture sprinkled in there, like how it was important things, some things, it, all of it was important to remember. And it was almost like, you know, it, you know, in order for Leo to complete the journey to like get to the next step, he had to like remember a little something from a little something. And it's like, yeah, you don't have to like be a master of everything, but it pays to pay attention in almost every subject, regardless of like maybe how worthless you think it is or how useless, I'm never going to use this. But it's like, well, Leo remembered, you know, the first three or four lines of you know, the Bible, like, yeah, oh, okay. Yeah, or like, okay. Yeah, or even, but even it's like, even the Fibonacci sequence, it's like, there could be argued that it's math, but it's still like, once you see it, like illustrated, you're like, oh my God, like, and then it also like, for me, just as a reader, you know, in my early 30s, it's like, bullshit. It's like, how did I not notice this in my world, in my environment, in nature and everything? And it's like, well, yeah, the Fibonacci sequence can, you can see it in a part of everything. And I'm just like, well, damn, now I'm going to pay a little bit more attention now. Just, you know.
So the Fibonacci sequence, and what I find really interesting is the mathematical rhythm in music. Like you're listening to math and it's hitting your brain in a way that is like one of my favorite quotes is like, art is how we decorate space, but music is how we decorate time. And just it's the same application, but it's in terms of like the pleasing rhythm of math, but applied to music. Like Da Vinci was taking all of the geometry and applying that to art and finding a way to, like, you know, I mean, the mathematics that are in the Last Supper and like the ratios and everything are wonderful. But the same type of, and I think the crazy part is, I think a lot of it is intuitive. Like the Beatles were just three musical geniuses. That's rude to Ringo. Four musical geniuses and who just happened to all live somewhat near each other in Liverpool.
Right.
And then like pushed each other to get better and make their brains better and find these like interesting rhythms and patterns. And like, that's what Verrocchio was doing 500 years ago when he took Da Vinci in. And like Da Vinci was just taking that like wonderful talent that he had and trying to maximize it. And so, you know, like that's what my Leo is doing in this book. And like the real Da Vinci really was famously a little bit of a weirdo when he was, I mean, he was a weirdo his entire life, but like he was considered the weird kid kind of in his village, because like the way that his dad came back and like ended up putting him in as an apprentice with Verrocchio is the local Duke was like, wanted his shield painted. And, you know, like most people will be like, here's a rose. And it's like a terrible version of a rose. And Leonardo da Vinci painted such a vivid dragon on the front of this guy's shield that his dad was like, all right, well, I guess you're not going to be a rotary or a notary. Like, I guess I'm going to, I'll pay for art school. He painted this beautiful thing. And yeah, I mean, I don't know. Sometimes I just get too excited and I lose the thread. Just the amount of competencies that he had, and like extraordinary competencies, is what it's just like, that's every time I would discover something new, I would be like, oh, how do I weave this into the narrative?
Yeah, no, but you did it so well, because I didn't, it, you know, and for you to like, I imagine it was probably challenging, not just to switch channels for your writing, but also to switch audiences, you know, from late night, you know, viewers to middle schoolers. Like, but I think you did it. You did such a good job of, you know, making the content like so digestible, you know, especially since, you know, arguably at that age range, it's, you know, maybe their attention spans are a little like, you know, it's hard to get their attention, and you know, they're bouncing everywhere, and yeah, they don't always want to sit down and read a book. But yeah, I think you did a great job of like adjusting that reading level, or feeding off of that reading level, feeding off of that age range, while also managing to, you know, like the editor said, sneaking that spinach into the brownies and sneaking in little life lessons and keeping their attention with that humor. And also with, you know, showing them like it pays to pay attention in school, and it pays to, you know, not you want to be careful not overlook the details because, you know,
I mean, if I can find a way to have entertained 13-year-olds the same way I've managed to engage a early 30s podcaster with two master's degrees, like if I can find a way, if you can find anything where both groups are, no, they're not, you're probably not absorbing it the same way, but they're both like, oh yeah, this was fun. That's it.
No, a mission accomplished. just a couple more questions before we wrap up here. So, and you kind of touched upon it. What are you hoping that readers, at the end of the day, what do you hope that readers of any age get out of Leo's story?
I mean, really the pursuit of truth. I feel like we're really kind of in danger of losing the thread that started with the Renaissance and pursuing truth above superstition and pursuing truth rigorously.
Yeah.
And man, I feel like that's really been at risk over the past few years.
Yeah.
So I just hope that kids are reading this and are just like, I had fun. I've got a bunch of jokes and I would love to try and make something beautiful that also contributes to my community and possibly, you know, like makes things better for a huge group of people. It's pretentiously aspirational.
You set the bar for yourself. And I think, you know, you've at the very least met that bar.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. It's not, I mean, I don't know. I don't see that when you say those things, I don't see it as pretentious. I see that you're just kind of trying to be honest with yourself. Maybe it's you've mastered, you know, certain things in your professional aspirations. And it's like, you're going for that next step. You're going for the next goal. You're going for the next project.
You know what? I would lose my mind if it happens. And I've thought about this a couple of times. Like when I would go for long walks to try and like get past certain plot points and you try and imagine like a future where this thing is finds an audience. And if I'm ever at like a Comic-Con or something and I see a kid in the Leo mech suit or some bird of the Leo mech suit, I will do cartwheels in a public place if I see a kid with a homemade
mech suit,
like the one that Leo wears, or somebody cosplaying as Gemini, the giant lion.
Yeah, right.
It's like, that will be like, okay, this was 100% worth the 8 years of pain.
You're like, I saw some cosplay. Okay, that was my goal. I'm good. It's like, besides the fact, you know, like screw the little kids if they don't learn anything. I got a little homemade mock suit there. Mm-hmm. That's awesome. Are there any more sequels? You kind of left it like a little bit open-ended at the same time. Maybe it was a little bold.
It's definitely planned out. I have a second book beat out. Would you want to talk about what the cliffhanger that it ends on? Or
we don't have to because we're trying to be spoiler free.
Oh, okay, we are.
I don't want to give away too much, but I'm excited. I were like definitely my face lit up. You know, when I finished the book, I was like, wait, that's it. It was like a warm, fuzzy feeling, but at the same time, I'm like, oh man,
if there is a second book, it would, a lot of the puzzles would be music based.
Okay. Yeah.
Because of kind of the way that the cliffhanger hung in. And I feel like I kind of, if this book finds an audience and kids are coming up to me over the next couple of years and being like, what's going on? Like, what am I missing?
Yeah.
I am just going to write down the address of the mansion, of Wynn Mansion, because that kind of gives away the goat of what is going on with the house.
Okay.
It's one of the other, Raphael's School of Athens, that painting, which is just like the Avengers of thought over the, because it's like Da Vinci is the guy in the middle and there's all of these other, like Aristotle's in there, and they're all these wildly influential artists and philosophers are in that Raphael School of Athens. And I was just like, that's kind of the world of this, is be like, oh man, if it got a sequel, I would get to introduce like Caravaggio and all these other kind of wild Renaissance artists and scholars of moving into the Enlightenment and those guys and those women.
Yeah. No, that's so cool. No, I'm rooting for you, and I would love to see
you. Thank you. I appreciate
it. I would love to see more of Leo and Dante, right?
Yeah.
That's his name. Yeah.
I think I'm going to record the audiobook, and I'm really hoping that the audiobook, I'm just imagining how kids would listen to an audiobook and just being in the back seat of, you know, like a Ford Explorer with a screen in the back of your dad's headrest.
Right.
And just listening to an audiobook. And I'm hoping they can let me put the illustrations in the audiobook. So kids are kind of looking at it and being like, wait, what? And just, yeah. I mean, the best case scenario is the kid stops and be like, Dad, what is going on?
Yeah, right.
Dad, what is the Palazzo Vecchio? Or, you know, like, I'm hoping this book results in a whole lot of parents having to Google stuff and then being like,
right. Okay, have a conversation about it. Yeah. I know, exactly. Yeah, unless they, you know, unless they have an affinity towards Italian Renaissance or history or anything like that. Maybe they've already forced some things down their kids' throats, but who knows? It's like my kids are going to grow up to be readers, whether they like it or not. Cause I'm such a bookworm, and like my husband's an engineer, and it's like, I'd be happy with that too. So yeah, no, for sure. But thank you so much, Luke.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, this was so much fun. Seriously, this book is so cool and it's so fun and it's so easy to digest. And
I was terrified that it was going to be hard for people to read.
Like, right?
That's what I was worried about.
No, I can't tell if you're joking because it was so easy to read.
I honestly, that was my biggest concern, is there's someone else left a review on Goodreads and was just like, I couldn't believe how quickly I got through this book that I thought was going to be very long. Like, I honestly talked to the publisher about, like, hey, could we just like not count the illustrations as pages to reduce the page count? Because just imagine, I can't tell you how many times I went to the library in middle school and watched kids open a book and go, 320 pages.
Yeah,
no
right.
Way.
Right.
Just, like, throw it. And I was just like, please don't throw my book.
Exactly, right? Or at least flip through some pages to see that it's not really all.
I swear you're going to have fun if you just pick it up. Yeah.
Oh, no. And I think that's important too, to have the sketches in there anyway. It's just maybe just skip over that number. Like, just skip over those numbers when you're numbering the pages. I'm excited about this book. I'm excited for you. I would say very successful debut, hopefully, but I guess only the numbers will tell next month. But you know, I would say if you've got any other ideas for future stories that don't necessarily have to do with Leo, go for it.
Thank you.
Yeah. You've definitely got a knack for this.
Awesome.
Know, and any challenges you face, you know.
Well, I appreciate someone who digests like 10 books a month saying,
no, this was an easy one. I saw the electronic version I received, it said only like 207 pages. So I was like, oh, this is great. Like, I'll be able to finish. Yeah. And then when the chapters were quicker, I was like, oh, perfect. You know, it was like, cause I try to squeeze in reading whenever I can. So it was, I appreciated the layout for sure. Yeah. So thank you so much.
You.
Best of luck. And thanks. And
thanks for the review.
Yeah, no, for sure. I'm excited to get it out there. I'm excited to, you know, help you push the book out there too. So
all right. I'll come back to the Nerd Cantina for the sequel.
Yep. We'll be ready for you. So
all right. Thank you.
Awesome. Thank you. Have a good one.
All right. And thanks for listening to this Cantina conversation between Megan and Luke Cunningham. You can pick up his book at Amazon or anywhere you could pick up a copy of a book these days, but you could also go find it over at the show notes for this episode here, the nerdcantina.com/show141. And his social media handles and links to purchase the books all can be found there. As always, we appreciate you giving us a listen. We hope you enjoyed. Join us over at thenerdcantina.com/community or over at the private Facebook group and join over in the community. Let us know what you think. Engage in other conversations, and let's keep building out this nerd group here. With all that said, thanks again. We'll talk to you next week.